Happy Labor
Day. Oh, no.
Oh, huge mistake.
Wow. Right out of
you
the gate.
You take that breath just
right out of the gate.
Hoping someone will just introduce, but then when everyone does it at the same time,
I don't do
really
it anymore.
Because
I like to listen
but
to
you. But you like
guys.
To wrap the episode, I've begun to notice.
I wrap up the episode.
Yeah, you do.
That's true.
Yes.
You're good at it.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
You shunned my Price is Right introduction, so I, you know.
Anyways.
Oh, your Carnival Barker one?
It's the Bob Barker. Thank you very much.
Wow.
All right.
So
we'll
everybody,
be right back.
Welcome back to We Rebel. We're here. It's Labor Day weekend. We hope you're having a wonderfully calm and relaxed
But you're probably not
weekend.
Because everything's wrong in this country. Let's jump into Russia.
Yeah, so I guess we'll just start right at the top. So this New York Times article by Matt Apuzzo and Maggie Haberman, Felix Sater. Trump associate boasted that Moscow business deal will get Donald elected.
This is from the very beginning of the week, which feels like it was months ago.
That feels like it was months ago.
Yeah. Do you wanna?
Well,
oh,
yeah.
It's so funny language.
Okay. Language, right. Okay. So essentially, Sater, a business. A business associate of President Trump promised in 2015 to engineer a real estate deal with the aid of President of Russia, Vladimir V. Putin, that he said would help Mr. Trump win the presidency. Sater wrote a series of emails to Trump's lawyer, Michael Cohen, a big friend of our podcast, in which he boasted about his ties to Mr. Putin and predicted that building a Trump Tower in Moscow would highlight Mr. Trump's savvy negotiating skills and be a political boon for his candidacy. So eventually they theorized that they were going to make this Trump Tower, Trump building, anything. And then somehow that was going to be the bastion for, oh, Trump is great at foreign negotiations. He should be president.
Well, and they made it sound like it wasn't a big deal, but it was, you know, because Michael Cohen was like, oh, well, this was like a preliminary thing. It wasn't really that big of a deal. But then it was like months and months of work. And it's just so fascinating because anytime you ever tell and anytime Trump has anything about him, it's always like the biggest or the best. And it's always been the most work. And then when it's about Russia, it's like, yeah, no, it wasn't that big of a deal. It was just sort of like a thing. Like, come on.
Yep.
I love the language of the email. Our boy can become president of the USA and we can engineer it. No punctuation. Also,
our
can
boys.
I just point out? But I love that they call him like our boy.
No, but also,
like, no.
Also, he said, I arranged for Ivanka to sit in Putin's private chair at his desk and office in the Kremlin. And then this article goes on and says, Ms. Trump said she had no involvement in the discussions about the Moscow deal. In a statement, she said that during the 2006 trip, she took a brief tour of Red Square in the Kremlin as a tourist. She said it's possible she sat in Mr. Putin's chair during that tour, but she did not recall it. So they don't recall. What's his name? Sergey, the Russian ambassador.
Mm-hmm.
What's his
Kislyak.
Last name? Kislyak. Thank you. They don't recall Kislyak. They don't recall the meetings at the Mayflower.
They don't recall 100 meetings. Mm-hmm.
They don't recall
Jared Kushner.
And then Ivanka doesn't recall
meeting
sitting in
Putin.
The. But I mean, even if it's just such a weird thing to say, if I sat in the chair of any world leader,
I would remember.
I would remember.
I would
probably.
Definitely remember.
It's like they've tricked her, like, hey, sit in this chair. Psych.
Yeah.
You know, like you would know that these things are.
Like have her sit in a chair and then like 10 days later be like, oh, by the way, that was Putin's chair.
Yeah, you know that red square that you were in? That was the Kremlin.
I feel like, you know, if you told
them, you were wondering.
If you went up to them with a cake and said happy birthday, they'd be like, prove it. You know, but so the thing about this is that this leads into our next topic.
Oh, wait, can I say something?
Oh, please.
Absolutely.
Yeah, go ahead.
Vladimir's middle name is Vladimirovich. So I was just curious what the V was.
Vlad. Vlad squared.
Vlad Putin.
But yeah, so the next article from the Washington Post, Rosalind Helderman, Carol D. Lenig, Tom Hamburger, top Trump organization executive asked Putin aide for help on business deals. So Michael Cohen, that same attorney we were just talking about, sent an email in January 2016 to Dmitry Peskov, the Kremlin's top press aide. Quote, over the past few months, I've been working with a company based in Russia regarding the development of a Trump Tower.
That doesn't sound like something that they kind of just was, you know, willy-nilly. Over the past few months, they've been working on a project. Sorry.
And a specific project, the development of a Trump Tower.
Yeah, I just want to like highlight how bullshit everything is in the Trump world. Yeah.
So they said, without getting into lengthy specifics, the communication between our two sides has stalled. As this project is too important, I am hereby requesting your assistance. I respectfully request someone, preferably you, contact me so that I might discuss the specifics as well as arranging meetings with the appropriate individuals. I thank you in advance for your assistance and look forward to hearing from you soon. Then, a quote, it should come as no surprise that over four decades, the Trump Organization has received and reviewed countless real estate development opportunities, both domestic and international. Cohen said in a statement to the Post, the Trump Moscow proposal was simply one of many development opportunities that the Trump Organization considered and ultimately rejected.
So again, bullshit.
And here's the thing. Also, even if it was one of many, he's currently under investigation for, you know, Russia.
Collusion with Russia.
What's the word? Collusion?
He said treason. At no time he's ever have had any deals with Russia. He said that many times. His son said that in 2008... they definitely were getting a lot of money from Russia, and then he backtracked on that. And then he said he's never had any projects with Russia, and we have clear evidence of development of a project in Russia.
A specific project in Russia.
I think my favorite part about this is that these emails were sent to the Kremlin's just general public email. Like, this is like where they take their normal everyday, like,
well,
hey.
Like what John Oliver says, it's stupid
Can
Watergate.
Can we email them?
Yeah,
I think we should email them.
Yeah, from our We Rebel podcast at gmail.com.
Yep.
Yeah. By the way, we didn't get any emails. I challenged people last week to talk to me about policy. If you're a Trump listener, I'd love to hear it. Instead, we got a mean review.
Oh, but we also got a good one.
Oh, great. Not that we're looking,
but if you're listening, we appreciate reviews.
Moving on. Yeah, rate us 5 stars. Give us a good review. It doesn't matter to us.
At all. But especially Nick.
Especially me. I don't work.
He doesn't read it late at night. While he's trying to fall asleep.
Yeah, I'm fine. I'm comfortable with who I am. Always have been.
So, continue to the next topic. The next article, rather, Manafort notes from the Russian meeting refer to political contributions. This is from NBC News. Ken Dionlean.
I think it's Dion Leon.
Dion Leon. Yeah. And Carol E. Lee. So Paul Manafort's notes from a controversial Trump Tower meeting with Russians during the 2016 presidential campaign included a mention of political contributions near a reference to the Republican National Committee. Two sources briefed on the evidence told NBC News. So it is illegal for foreigners to donate to American elections. The meeting happened just as Trump had secured the Republican nomination for the president, and he was considered a long shot to win. Manafort was the campaign chairman at the time.
So,
and again, it's another thing added to the list of things that are being portrayed by the Trump administration as coincidences.
Well, I think it's also a little interesting, and
there's so much information. Just tell us what's going on.
Right. Well, that too.
Because obviously it's something. Yeah, sorry to keep interrupting.
No, it's fine.
Try and talk. I dare you.
No, I think it's interesting too, and not to get all tinfoil hatty, but I mean, when Obama, and there was that big Rolling Stone article where Obama wanted to push more than just the sanctions that were put upon on Russia when there was clear evidence of their meddling in our 2016 election, he wanted a bipartisan approach to that.
Right.
And Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan and a lot of Republican higher-ups shot that down. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's interesting that we're now starting to hear about potential illegal donations made to not just the Trump organization, but to the Republican Party as a whole. Again, I don't want to get ahead of myself, and I want to be very clear that I'm not, you know, I will believe it when you know,
data.
When it's on my table in front of me. Mm-hmm. But I think it's very interesting that this stuff is cropping up. And
But sadly, I'm also not that surprised.
Right. So Mueller has an early draft of the Trump letter giving reasons for firing Comey.
Even before I read this article, I was like, shouldn't we already have this letter?
I think that,
like, in normal business, in normal just operational protocol, before you fire someone, you have the letter and the reason, and you outline it to them and to the people, you know, that you allegedly report to, which in government is the public.
Well, the head of our government's an evil casino man, so everything's kind of slow.
But casinos are fun. Just came back from Vegas. Hashtag Labor Day weekend 2017. Yeah,
they're fun, but they're also very dangerous.
Right. Mm-hmm. No, I mean, we only bet $2 and we lost it. But for a second, we had $5 and it was really
exciting.
I set
a limit. I went to Vegas once and I set a limit about how much money I was comfortable losing.
Our limit was $2. Mm-hmm. What was your limit?
It was $150, most of which I lost.
Bold.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Proud of you, though.
I thought that was my first time. I would dip my toe in. Okay, so Mueller yes. has an so early draft.
The letter that we should have already had is now we yes. have a draft of. Yes.
So,
carry on, Nick.
So this is an article from Michael S. Schmidt and Maggie Haberman. Maggie Habes, a love on our podcast. I think we mention her every podcast. If you want to come on, you're more than welcome. So she wrote that the special counsel, Robert S. Mueller III, which I didn't know he was at the third, has obtained a letter drafted by President Trump and a top political aide that offered an unvarnished view of Mr. Trump's thinking in the days before the president fired the FBI director. Excuse me. The letter drafted in May was met with opposition from Donald F. McGahn II, the White House counsel who believed that its angry, meandering tone was problematic, according to interviews with a dozen administration officials and others briefed on the matter. Among Mr. McGahn's concerns were reference to private conversations the president had with Mr. Comey, including times when the FBI director told Mr. Trump he was not under investigation in the FBI's continuing Russia inquiry. So in this article, which is really fascinating, and you should definitely read it, they also make note of how Stephen Miller was helping. Stephen Miller, we all know, is the most racist sentient bowling pin that's ever lived.
Gosh.
He had a lot to do also with this angry, sort of insane letter about why that Comey should be. And I think it's really interesting because when it first came out, Trump said that he was making his decision to fire Comey based on the recommendation of Attorney General Sessions and Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein. And we are now finding out that that was not the case. I think he's very mad because he's being actively investigated for Russia. And then he used Rosenstein to cover his tracks. Mm-hmm. So
sure.
So the timeline just doesn't add up, and that's why it's like, hey.
Yeah, it's just, they're now, the lies are getting, they're mounting
They're having cascading effects.
Yeah, there's...
Like,
there's,
since we don't know where ground zero is, of baseline, of this is what has happened, X, Y, Z, all these other pieces, it's like the American public is having to piece together the puzzle, and that's not really our job.
Well, but I just think, too, it's like, you know, it's, yeah, their lies are built on lies upon lies. It's a house of cards.
Yes.
On Netflix.
It's a show.
Which
big
I will pause just real quick to we were talking about the lies it's building up. There is a Washington Post article from August 22nd. I'd saved this a while ago. It's the title is President Trump's List of False and Misleading Claims Tops 1,000.
Yeah.
If you have a chance, go ahead and look at it because you'll see a compiled list of exactly what he's lying about.
Speaking of, there was a political article that came out titled Justice Department No Evidence Obama Wiretapped Trump Tower by Matthew Nussbaum. And essentially, the DOJ made a statement summary saying the FBI and Department of Justice have now sided with former Director Comey and in confirming and wiring and confirmed in writing. Hello. The President Trump lied when he was tweeting that former President Obama wiretapped him at Trump Tower.
Yeah. So I don't know if we need to go too much into this.
We don't. That's no. Just, you know,
just because he tweets
just
it at 3 in the morning.
Of that.
Yeah. It's just ridiculous.
Anywho, moving on. Can we move on?
Yeah. Let's get on to, I think that this is probably the biggest news of the week. Hurricane Harvey, which has absolutely devastated Houston. And we're going to talk about some things. There's a mishandling of it. And we want to be very clear, and we discussed this before we started recording, that we are not trying to politicize a national tragedy, but we do need to talk about the mishandling of this and what it means to be presidential in a time of need and a time of comforting and how Donald Trump has not really done that.
And before we even get into the details, like, you know, from where the three of us are sitting, I think overarching, we want to send out like good vibes and love and prayers and all the above to the families of not only Houston, but surrounding areas.
Louisiana.
Mm. And then also all of the cities and areas that are, you know, helping as people are exiting.
So. And we'll talk about this more with our interview later, but if you feel like you need to get involved in some way, there are various organizations that you can donate to. We'll be talking with one specific one in just a little bit.
Yeah, and also just to be clear, and there needs to be more news coverage of this, but there's massive flooding happening in South Asia. We're not covering that right now.
Sure.
But just thoughts, prayers, and vibes out
to
that
those
as well.
People as well.
Okay. So,
what a crowd!
What a crowd! What a turnout!
Not a thing to say.
I mean, this first visit, there were two visits, and you know, to be fair, he went back again and he did meet with people. But in this first visit, it's just by the book. I mean, he goes out and he greets a crowd of people that don't have homes. They're not there for him. And he said, what a crowd, what a turnout. And I just think it's like this is such a hole-in-one easy move as a president.
Yeah.
You go down to a place that's been hit. You talk to the victims. You help out. And
that's really it.
Yeah. Yeah. And then you do the government stuff, but the photo op, I mean, how do you fuck that up?
Yeah. Just go.
And then, so Trump hails hurricane relief efforts as he visits Texas. President Trump and the First Lady, this is from the BBC, visited Texas earlier in the week but stayed clear of the disaster zone, saying they did not want to divert resources from rescue work, which is actually a fair thing to say.
Yep, mm-hmm. Decent. Yep.
And then visiting Texas again on Saturday, Mr. and Mrs. Trump made a point of meeting flood survivors and volunteers in Houston. They took part in food distribution at a shelter, handing out packed lunches and posed for photographs with victims when they requested it. And so you think, yay, that's fantastic, right? Great. But then the Washington Post drops an article today that says the Trump administration wants to tie Harvey recovery aid to the debt ceiling legislation. And this is an article written by Arielis R. Hernandez, William Wan, Katie Zazima, and Hazma Shaban. And so the Trump administration, this is from the article, the Trump administration said Sunday that it wants Congress to attach aid for victims of Hurricane Harvey to a bill that would increase the federal debt limit, a move that clashes with an influential group of House conservatives who have warned GOP leaders not to connect to the two funding initiatives. Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin revealed the administration's approach Sunday morning when he asked whether the White House could grant the funding for the disaster, which would not be attached to the fight in Washington over the debt ceiling. And he said, our first priority is to make sure that the state gets money. It's critical. And to do that, we need to make sure that we raise the debt limit. Without raising the debt limit, I'm not comfortable they will get the money that we need this month to Texas to rebuild. So I get it. Economically, I understand where he's coming from. I just think a debt ceiling should be separate. It should be separate because that's a political fight.
Yeah.
And you know, who knows what other amendments get attached on to that, and that will happen.
That fly under the radar because everyone's focused on what's happening.
Right. And those amendments are always the things that kind of come back to haunt us. So I just think that there should be absolutely a separate bill, and it should be treated as such. I understand economically, but you know, then get this debt ceiling fixed.
Yeah, that's one issue, and this is a separate issue.
Yeah,
you know what people need tomorrow in Texas is separate than the debt ceiling.
Right, and it's like a walk and chew gum thing. It's like Congress votes on bills all the time. Why can't they vote on back to back bills? I mean, maybe I'm not educated enough in that. And if you're listening, I'd love to hear a response to that. But sure. I just don't know why they can't vote for the debt ceiling and then they vote for funding.
Yeah, you can't use people's lives as bargaining chips. Yeah. You know, it's really not fair to them. They, you know, this is an act of God, unfortunately, and the recovery for Texas is going to be huge.
And it's going to take a long
time. It's going to take a long time. And so you can't hold that over their heads because you have a gripe about another issue that is unrelated to those people.
Right. And then moving on, Governor Abbott of Texas, Greg Abbott, says that Texas will accept Mexican offer of Hurricane Harvey relief. He said, yes, I have, and we are here. Abbott said from Austin, when journalists asked him about the topic, we had a list of aid and assistance that they have offered to provide that we are accepting. This is from the Dallas News. And then Carlos Sada, Mexico's Undersecretary for North America, said that Texas and Mexico share more than half the border. There are families, marriages, businesses that bind our two sides. Yep. This is about being good neighbors.
That is so big of them. And I like,
especially with everything else that's going on about the
Trump
wall.
Wants to fund a wall during this crisis.
And like, make them pay for it.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, which is ridiculous.
It's so like,
and we're going to get to DACA. So
yes, we'll get to that in a second. But
The other thing I wanted to bring up also about Harvey is that on Thursday, the White House press secretary, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, reported that President Trump was going to donate $1 million of his quote unquote personal money to Hurricane Harvey victims. But Friday, so 24 hours later, she was asked by a reporter whether if the donation would be coming from him, his own money or the Trump Foundation. And she quote unquote hadn't had a chance to do that. And so we still don't know, A, if the donation is going to come in, if the donation is going to be from him from his foundation. And so in theory, I was like, that's an excellent gesture because he does have a lot of money and great. Like, let's do it. You know, but again, you haven't had a chance to do it. Like, these people need the money now. Mm-hmm. These people don't have access to food now. There are people that are still in their homes now. So if there's anything a priority for your staff, it's if that's an easy fix, if that's an easy way to move some aid down there, just do it. Just get it done.
Or just don't say you're gonna do it. Yeah. Like if you're not gonna follow through on your claim, just don't bring it up.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. I agree.
Anywho, that was from Think Progress.
Yes. So
carrying on.
DACA. Let's get to DACA. So this is just breaking, honestly, so it's not been completely confirmed yet, but
first of all, DACA is the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals.
Right.
Yes.
So DACA, and this is just from Wikipedia, DACA allows certain illegal immigrants who entered, undocumented immigrants, excuse me, that's just what I read, undocumented immigrants who entered the country as minors to receive a renewable 2-year period of deferred action from deportation and eligibility for a work permit. This is a policy that President Obama enacted that has helped millions of people. It cannot be stressed how much influence this has over people's lives.
And when we say people, also we're talking about children.
We're talking about children. Yeah. We're talking about people in the workforce. I mean, we're talking about people that pay taxes. We are, you know, talking about friends. I mean, this is, I just think it's, and earlier in the week, you know, House Speaker Ryan on Friday, this is from a CNN article written by Tal Copan and Jim Acosta. He said, he was trying to defend it, and he said that it would not be, a good call to do this. Ryan is a famously spineless man. So you have to take everything with a giant grain of salt. Mm-hmm. It's a miracle that he can walk. But
such an asshole.
But I just I have no respect for him. It's but okay. he you know, even he is coming out and saying, you know, that he might not like the way this was done by Obama through executive action, but he thinks that it's a program which is
important.
Even and religious leaders
That's the thing that really hit me, is that more than 300 religious leaders will send letters to President Trump urging him not to eliminate that.
Yeah, and I just think
specific plan, which makes sense because most religions, you know, inspire people to do good for others, treat others like you want to be treated, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it's like we're talking about people that don't have the that are in these positions coming into the country and don't have the power to change anything. Mm-hmm. So like, let's help them so that they become active citizens.
Well, I mean, I just
and
think
that they are contributing to what we have, the infrastructure we've put in place here as America.
Before I interrupt you,
it's
Nick,
it's the ROI on that is very high.
Right. And you were talking about
return on investment, like you're investing in them and they come back as workers.
That was for the listeners. I wasn't confused.
Okay.
But we're talking about over 800,000 people here that have been positively affected by this, you know, that are actively trying to seek education and work through, you know, in the United States. And I've seen a lot of people on with arguments saying like, oh, well, they're illegal, so they should just be kicked out. It's like, well, okay, they didn't move here illegal, like on their own like volition. They were just like, they came here with their families, you know, and when they're actively trying to be a productive member of society, who are you to say that they don't deserve to do that? You know, we're supposed to be America, land of the free, home of the brave. Let people, you know, live their lives, pave their own future. So you can't take that out of their hands just overnight like
that. Well, I mean, you also, but I was watching a video on Twitter today where this conversation, this question was asked about undocumented immigrants to George H.W. Bush and Ronald Reagan at a 1980, like a presidential conference they had. Mm-hmm. And both of them were like, you know, these are good, hardworking people. And it is important to try and figure this out. You know, they are here for a reason. They are here following a dream. And I just don't know where the modern Republican Party has gone. And this is Trump is their problem. I mean, this is a vindictive man who is making, I mean, California is on fire right now. Houston is underwater. We have North Korea getting, and we'll talk about that in a second, but North Korea has now a hydrogen bomb that can possibly fit on an ICBM, which is an intercontinental ballistic missile. and see, I don't know what
ROI is.
He
knows acronyms, guys. He knows
acronyms. But I'm just saying all of these things are happening, right? Mexico is offering aid.
Everything that Donald Trump has been saying
worldwide,
to them for the past 3 years.
These things are happening. Mexico is helping out. The world is coming together. And then Donald Trump, because he's
leaving the Paris Accord,
is truly jealous of President Obama. I truly believe that. I think he got his feelings hurt at the 2011 White House Correspondents' Dinner. And I think that he is letting that... Shout out to Prashant Venkat. And I think he is letting that drive everything. And I just think that the Republican Party needs to own this, and they need to stop it. And now it's going to be on the legislative chopping block. And if the Republican Party is truly the party of Lincoln, then I think it's time that we look out for everybody.
Show that
Abraham Lincoln, a man famous for the Emancipation Proclamation and bringing, you know, people together, quote unquote. I think if they're going to really tote that around, now is the time, because it's truly the man. The president is a shame on this country, and I think the Republican Party needs to really step up. And Paul Ryan needs to, you know, put some action behind his words.
And on the,
I mean, at least he's saying some different words. I'm going to just
says whatever feels, you know, like whatever will inflate his body so that he can handle it. And then he goes home and deflates, and then he has to be plugged back into his weird little like Fox News machine. I just can't stand him.
All right.
Oh, God. Who's that guy that's running against him? The Iron Stash. What's that guy's
Iron
name?
Stash?
Yeah, he goes by the Iron Stash on Twitter. I just want to give him a shout out. Hold on. Iron Stash. Well, Randy Bryce is running against Paul Ryan in his district in Wisconsin. Check him out. The dude rocks. He's an iron worker. He did an awesome ad. get Paul Ryan out of Congress. Not only are we going to take back the House, we're going to get Paul Ryan completely out of the Congress, and then we're going to come after that stupid turtle, Mitch McConnell. Oh, God. It's
if his shell doesn't hit him first.
Yeah. So.
All right.
Let's rock and
moving
roll.
Moving on.
Are we? Well, the last thing I just want to say on that point was, which is beautifully said, Nick, was that for the people on the ground, though, just what we need to get rid of is our elitist entitled mentality. All right. No one is owed anything in this country. We all earn it. So do not think that just because there's an undocumented citizen under this act, they're receiving help. They're giving time to actually try to make something of themselves in this country. Do not say that they have taken your job.
Yeah.
Or they've taken
right.
your spot.
Right, right, right.
No, that is you,
also,
you know,
ridiculous.
Not
yeah.
at all. And I've seen that a lot
yes.
in arguments.
And I think that also something to point out mm-hmm. is a lot of the jobs that they're quote unquote allegedly taking mm-hmm. are also jobs that people don't want.
Right.
Mm-hmm. It's just, it's,
you know, and so it's mm-hmm. like if you're that again is a different is a fear tactic of how to look at the situation. And again, I agree with what you're saying. If they don't have the information that they need to become legal, mm-hmm. you know, and they don't speak English for XYZ reason, or they're, mm-hmm. you know, a 3-year-old kid, or insert any reason here, mm-hmm. you know, this program is that bridge to getting a job, getting involved, becoming a citizen, paying taxes, getting those documents in place. And here we go.
Yeah.
You know, we need to have that in there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, all right. But do you know who said... Do you know who said, okay, I just want to say that Paul Ryan today even came out and was like, we're all born on the same foot. The only thing, the thing that brings us all together is opportunity. And that's where it takes you. I'm sorry. That's not true. So mm-hmm. anyway, rant over. Sorry.
Yes.
I'm all
right. We have two more quick points before we jump in with our fantastic guests.
Let's go to North Korea,
yeah,
obviously.
Just real quick. Yeah.
So North Korea has developed a hydrogen bomb, and they can now supposedly attach it to an intercontinental ballistic missile. And then this is from a CNN article that dropped today, written by Angela Dewan, Tahoon Lee, and Eli Watkins. And it says U.S. Defense Secretary James Mattis warned of a massive military response to any threat from North Korea against the United States or its allies in a statement outside the White House after a meeting with President Donald Trump, Vice President Mike Pence, and top national security advisors. And I just, he said, our commitment among the allies are ironclad. Any threat to the United States or its territories, including Guam or our allies, will be met with a massive military response, a response both effective and overwhelming. Okay. Then he said, we are not looking to the total annihilation of a country, namely North Korea. But as I said, we have many options to do so. Just shut up. What is going on right now?
Mm-hmm.
It's just pure chaos, and I don't really know what to do about that right now. I know that a lot of people are scared. I don't know.
I don't know either. I'm not going to claim to be an expert.
You know,
how
we talked,
fix that.
We talked last week about what to do with you know, things that have happened in the past. President Clinton's handling of North Korea, which, you know, has a lot of problems. Mm-hmm. I just don't think that them getting nukes and then us provoking them
is a good plan.
Is the way to go.
Not at
also,
all.
Trump said that we will potentially end all trade with countries that are doing trade with North Korea,
you
which includes China.
And you know who else is on that list? Russia.
Yeah.
So
that's probably not going to happen.
Yeah.
So that's definitely not going to happen.
Then we should.
All right, quickly.
No, I think you want to.
Yeah, and then just from the world of Ivanka, the White House, with the backing of Ivanka, will end an Obama-era policy that would have required business owners to document how much they pay their workers alongside their gender, race, and ethnicity. So I'm not sure what she's doing to end the wage gap of, what is it, 80 cents on a dollar?
Yeah.
Yeah. If we're rounding
for
up.
For white women.
I think.
We're rounding up at 79
cents. 79 cents on the dollar for white women. And it's less than that for African American women. And even less than that for Latino women. Circling back to our interview with Betsy Butler of the California Women's Law Center. But, you know, like as one of the only women in the White House right now, that is your cross. That is your thing to bear. You are supposed to be fighting for that. I just, it's absurd and it's crazy.
Yeah.
But anyways, on to our very exciting guest. We're super honored
that
our guest is coming on, and he's from the Red Cross, and we'll be back in just a minute.
Stick around.
All right.
Thanks.
Bye. Bye.
All right. right. Well, we're back with our guest. We're so honored and excited to have John Myers, the Regional Director of Communications for the Red Cross in Los Angeles, on to join us at such a timely moment. So, John, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'd love to hear, maybe we could start with your background and how you became engaged in the Red Cross and how you kind of wove your career to get to where you are.
Yeah.
It's a great, it's a super specific question. So, you know.
No, no problem. You know, I've been doing communications work for close to 20 years now. So it's been a while, primarily in a private sector. I did some as a public relations specialist in some PR firm. But mostly I've been working in government. So I worked down in San Diego for a while in the mayor's office there, the county board of supervisors, and ended up working in the Schwarzenegger administration. So I've been up in Sacramento for about 14 years doing communications work, media relations within the government sector. But Sacramento just got a little too hot for me, and I kind of wanted to branch out a little bit more. A great opportunity came along with Red Cross. What an incredible mission they have. It seemed to fit everything I was looking for, the fulfillment that I was looking for, and I couldn't pass up the opportunity to join the Red Cross. So that's what brings me here today.
Yeah, and so what is it about Red Cross? What are they doing? You know, not to say like any place is better in terms of making donations to, but you know, what is it about Red Cross that attracted you to working with them?
You know, if you just look at the Red Cross mission statement, it's a short statement, but just the first line alone is the Red Cross mission is to alleviate human suffering. Right there says it all. You know, that's a place that I'd like to belong. An organization that makes it their goal to go out and help other beings. We do it in many different ways, and we do it through the generosity of donors and through the kindness of our volunteers. Red Cross works primarily with volunteers. Over 90% of all the efforts Red Cross does is done by a volunteer. So a lot less staff, paid staff, and a lot more volunteers to come out and help this organization do what it does.
Wow. And now we always hear about, you know, you hear about these places like Red Cross during some sort of natural disaster, right? That's probably the only time you're going to hear about them, at least on the news and commercials and things like that, right? So what, you know, when that comes up, what are the needs? We could tie this right now into Harvey, where, you know, all of a sudden saying, okay, guys, if you want to help out, please donate to Red Cross. You know, is it blood? Is it supplies? Is it food? What is the current need right now?
Yeah, let me just say yes. It's a simple answer to everything you just said. We do. And I want to back up. Before I answer that, you said something that's really a mission of my own that I'm trying to work on here in Los Angeles and change that narrative a little bit. You know, when we hear Red Cross, we think about the big disasters. We think about the big hurricane or the pending earthquake that's going to hit Los Angeles or the big floods in Louisiana. But one of the things that we have to remember is Red Cross is delivering their service every single day. Here in Los Angeles, for example, where I am, we have home fires. Every single day, on average, Red Cross is responding to a home fire. That takes resources. Those are volunteers going out with the Red Cross trucks to go take care of a family who are going through one of the most, you know, horrific moments of their life as their house burns down. And we work with them to comfort, care, find other shelter, find someplace else they can go. So Red Cross is doing this every day. What we're seeing now on the news obviously highlights what the Red Cross does best, you know, when in our big disasters, such as Hurricane Harvey as it struck. So going back to your question about what's needed, we need it all. Red Cross, we're very well prepared when it comes to disasters. It's what we do. We know when it's coming. We were on the ground in Texas well before the hurricane hit and making sure that we can help people prepare as much as possible. So we're ready. We have the materials. We have the resources ready to go. But we need to replenish all those resources. So it does take people donate blood. It does take financial donations so that we can continually stock food. You know, we provided over 500,000 $100,000, about a half a million meals and snacks to the people on the ground just over the last week. So that takes a lot of resources to replenish. So we have things like that. We go out and buy cleanup kits so that when these people are ready to go back into their house, we provide them with the cleaning tools necessary to go mop up after the damage. And, you know, that alone is just a lot of resources it takes. So, you know, we're definitely in need of everything as we move forward. And not to keep rambling on, but you got me started on this, so I'll continue on some of those resources. You know, we have to remember, this is not a sprint. You know, it's not going to be taken care of in just the week that Hurricane Harvey comes through. It's not going to take days, weeks, even months. We could be there well over a year helping the people of Texas to recover from a storm of this magnitude. And that's going to take a lot of financial resources to do so.
I'm curious, you know, with Hurricane Harvey, we've seen a lot of members of the city of Houston sort of getting into it and you know, not necessarily with training, but people are on boats, you know, people are wading in water. What is that like coming from an organization that specializes that when you're working alongside with people with no training? Is there flash training or is there advice that you would give to somebody that is going in as a responder before you guys might, you know, because if something happens immediately, somebody might just jump into it. So what is, I guess, what's the procedure for handling something like that?
You know, the thing to remember is Red Cross isn't a real first responder. Mm-hmm. You know, we're not in there pulling people out of the danger. And we admire those that are able to go do so. In a circumstance like this, it was just a special circumstance. You know, this was beyond what the local authorities or state authorities could handle. And they really did call upon the general public to come and assist, you know, with boats and people who have the means to do so. They worked side by side, from what I know, with the authorities to do that. So when we get into a situation like this as Red Cross, you know, we don't always have the amount of volunteers handy to take care of this as well. So we put a call out for people to join and be part of Red Cross and provide the services that we provide. And you know what? We do require a little bit of training, but it's very basic training. We kind of bring them in, show them the ropes real quick. And a lot of these people that are there on the ground volunteering come from the Houston area or come from the Texas area. And, you know, we right through the front door, we give them the basic training and they start volunteering and providing the services of Red Cross.
Right. And I mean, it sounds like, you know, and this is something probably most people know, that your number one partner is your volunteers, you know, but also, you know, knowing organizational development and, you know, habits of people, they'll volunteer for a week and then they got to get back to their life, you know? And so I assume that over the next few weeks and months and year that your volunteer account, I guess I would say, would fall off. So how do you manage that? Or do you have other partner organizations that you work with to combine forces, or do you continue to recruit in different kinds of ways? But how do you address that issue?
Yeah, and it's kind of the bench, so to speak. You know, we go through the roster and deploy. Red Cross is a great organization in the way that it mobilizes its volunteers. So the volunteers that you see there are not all Houston-based Red Cross volunteers. We actually start putting the call out across the nation. You know, we have 60-something different regions within the United States. I'm in the Los Angeles region, and where we have 5,000 volunteers just in the LA area alone. So we have a big pool of resources to pull from. We put the word out, and in a disaster like this, people want to give. They really do. And, you know, the outpouring of support from the volunteers in Los Angeles was huge. So right now, we probably have, I would say about 40, 50 volunteers, and we're looking at getting another 50 or so, if not more, out within the next week. Because exactly like you said, we know full well people are coming in to volunteers, but they have to get back to their lives. And so we line it up to replenish those volunteers. And if we're doing this, all the other regions are doing the same thing. They all have a lot of volunteers that are coming out willing to help, and we're kind of just rotating them through. We usually do about 2 week cycles with a volunteer because, you know, that's about as much as anyone can really be asked to give up on their life to go out and help others. So they go out and we replenish those volunteers with other volunteers. At this point, I don't see us being short on the amount of volunteers that want to come out and help. So I guess that's it says a lot for, you know, the willingness of our volunteers and the American people.
And is there any kind of virtual volunteering for those who, you know, they can't leave their places where they live? Is there a way for them to also get involved in that way?
Definitely. And I'm glad you brought that up, because we often neglect to talk about, you know, what people are doing from 2,000 miles away. In fact, one of my volunteers that works closely with me has been deployed since day one of this disaster virtually. And she spends a lot of time on social media, taking a look at what's happening in social media with a huge team of other virtual volunteers. And they're monitoring, you know, they're learning if there's any issues out there, people that are talking about it on a Twitter platform or Facebook or something like that, and being able to address needs that way. So, you know, we're not just boots on the ground, but we're boots in cyberspace as well.
Now, the big question always comes around with money. You know, no donation is too big, too small, anything like that. But where does that money go? Everyone's always asking, like, okay, I donated my $10. What is my $10 doing? How has it made an impact? People always want to know that.
Yeah, you know, that seems to be the hot topic lately. And a lot of people have raised questions on just where does that money go? And, you know, I can assure you, it's all going right back into the relief efforts for Hurricane Harvey. One of the things about Red Cross is we honor donor intent. If your intent is for your money to go to hurricane relief, that's where that money goes. And so that's where we spend that money. It's going to go back into the communities, back into preparedness and relief efforts to make sure that we're taking care of all the people that were affected by this disaster. So some of the simple things, you know, I talked about the shelters and what it takes to keep those shelters going. And that takes cots, it takes blankets, the food, you know, a lot of resources go into opening and keeping a shelter open. Right now we have, you know, over 32,000 people that stayed in a shelter last night. There's about 230 shelters open in the Houston area, and then there's more in Louisiana as well, where another 1,700 people stayed in shelters last night. You know, so when you take a look at 32,000 people, that's a small city right there, and that takes a lot of resources, financial resources, and that's where the money is going. And then you have to think about the long-term effects. As I said, this is not a sprint, it's a marathon. We're going to be there for months and over a year helping these communities rebuild, and that's where this money goes. It's going to help them rebuild. It's going to help people get their lives back together again, because, you know, they're going through one of the most horrific things they're ever going to go through. And it's going to take a lot of help, a lot of healing to get through this.
Now, I don't know if you have anything to do with this specifically, but I've been reading about how some of these people, they were living in zones where they were not given the option of having insurance for flood, because they were in a zone where, you know, you weren't supposed to get touched, nothing is supposed to happen. But now they've lost, you know, prized possessions, sometimes their entire homes. You know, can Red Cross in any way help with that?
You know what? I can't answer that specifically, because every situation is a little different. Mm-hmm. But what I can tell you is that that's one of the reasons we are there for the long haul and to help people out, because we're going to be able to work with residents that have lost everything, that may not have insurance. We're going to find resources for them. We're going to work with them. We're going to get them to the right government agencies or any other social programs that they may need to help them rebuild or find other housing. One way or the other, we are going to work with everyone. And if that means working with state insurance commissioners or any other authorities, that's what we're there to do.
And it sounds like, you know, not only are you exporting goods, you know, like toilet paper and all the above, but also you're serving as an ambassador for access to information, you know, so that these people can transition back into their lives and figure out, like, where do I go to get my new car? Where do I go to do this and that? Yeah. And so is there a virtual, you know, site for Harvey, you know, people that have been affected by Harvey to kind of start gathering that information? Or right now, are we still in the era of like immediate need?
Yeah, right now it really is. We're trying to just, you can still see the news reports. They're still, as of this morning, we're still in a rescue and recovery phase.
Right.
And they're still pulling people out of harm's way. And that's our primary focus. But absolutely, one of the reasons, you know, that I said we stay there so long is helping people with that, because Red Cross has been there. You know, we've been around for 130 something years. We've learned how to work with other agencies, with other organizations, how to work through the systems and get the help that you need. So we provide that service to those affected by a disaster. And so we certainly can work with them and help them navigate through those waters. You know, we see that in just about every disaster. That's one of the things that Red Cross really does well.
So, you know, shifting gears to talk about the California, we've had we're having a disaster, a crisis happening kind of on our front lawn. What is the protocol for something like that? Because you guys are dealing with, one of the worst floods and hurricanes in, you know, history. And now a fire, is it a similar protocol or is there a large changing of gears? And I guess, you know, more where you're stationed at. So I guess what are the first moments been like that for you?
Yeah, definitely. And we did. We had what they call the La Tuna Canyon fire going on right now in the Burbank area of Los Angeles. And last report I saw was probably around 6,000 acres that were burned. Wow. And it caused us to open up 3 evacuation shelters. So we've had residents. We had, you know, approximately about 50 residents the first night, and it dwindled down a little bit as people found other places to stay, you know, whether friends or family. But the process is very similar to the big disasters, and we get notified and we fill the needs. And in this case, well, unlike the hurricane, we kind of saw that coming. You know, the hurricane is going to hit. We didn't really know the intensity of that until it was actually happening, but we already had boots on the ground and people there ready to assist before the hurricane made landfall. With a fire, it erupts quickly and they move fast. But we work with our partners. In this case, it was the Los Angeles Fire Department, and they worked and told us, this is what's going on. We're going to evacuate. Let's get some shelters open. And that's what prompted us to open up the shelters. But it also demonstrates, again, what Red Cross does so well. With all our resources that we're putting towards Hurricane Harvey, we still have that ability to take care of the needs right here at home. We still have volunteers who will stand up and be ready at a moment's notice and help build those shelters up and staff them all night long. I spent most of my day at one of the shelters today, and it's not easy. It's when people are worried about their home being gone and they're not getting the information that they need because the firemen are out busy fighting that fire, and it's hard to tell which homes, if any, had been lost at that point. And so we're in the shelters working with them, consoling with them, just like we do in Texas right now. We have mental health workers that will go around and provide comfort and care, people that just need to talk. We have that in the shelters in a fire situation like we're doing here in Los Angeles as well.
And so I guess similar to Harvey, then what can be done right now? Like, you're talking to people, you know, they're just distraught because they're not getting the information they want. But is there anything that we can do right now? Just anyone listening?
You know, again, and sometimes it sounds like a broken record, but I can't say it any other way. Financial donations are what help, because it allows us to get the resources that we need in the places that we need them. You know, in any kind of disaster situation, we see it, whether it's large like the hurricane or some of the smaller brush fires or wildfires that we have here in California, the generosity of people is just amazing. People come out and they want to help donate. They want to bring clothes and food. One of the things that Red Cross does really well is we're prepared for disaster. So when it comes to food and water, we've got that well taken care of. And we love that people are that generous and want to come out. But really, the financial donations are the best way to help, because that's what's going to keep those shelters going. It's what's going to keep our trucks being able to go to the shelters and go out into the communities. Because once that fire is over and people are starting to rebuild, we actually have our emergency response vehicles that go out and help people, whether it's providing tools and equipment that are needed or just food and canteen services, you know, like drinks and snacks and things like that. So financial donations. We're designating funds right now for Harvey. So if you go to 1-800 or call 1-800 Red Cross or go to redcross.org, you can make a donation straight to Harvey. And as I said, you know, we honor donor intent. And so if you wanted to go to Harvey, that's where it's going to go. But the thing we have to remember, you know, these disasters are happening every day. So people who just donate to Red Cross to disaster relief, that money goes then to us being able to take care of all the disasters on a daily basis. So by going to redcross.org or calling 1-800-RED-CROSS, you can make a donation to disaster relief that will go to help wildfires here in Los Angeles area.
And also for those that you were saying earlier that you run on volunteers. So for people that want to volunteer, what's the process of getting involved that way?
You know, the best way to do that is go to redcross.org. They have a link on there. If you want to volunteer, you click here, you put in your zip code, it'll identify where you're from and just ask you a few other questions. But that's the best way to get you going. Right now, we're seeing a lot of people coming forward and doing that. And we love that. We love that people want to come out and really support the Red Cross.
Yeah, no, I was interested to hear. And remind me, when did you join the Red Cross?
I've been here just about 2 years now. Nice. Here in Los Angeles.
So I'm curious to know if there's been any kind of like influx of volunteers with based off of the current political climate and people are more wanting to give back to their neighborhood, or how does that ebb and flow go, you know, with, you know, everyone, you know, responses to what's happening in the world?
Yeah, you know, I can't say for certain that we've seen an uptick in volunteers over the years. We have seen a big outpouring from our younger generation. Younger people are just seem more apt to want to give back to their communities and be part of an organization that provides a humanitarian service to their communities. And it's a wonderful thing to see. I love seeing the young people come into our organization because they provide a perspective that just helps us in so many different ways, how to reach out through social platforms and other media ways. So they've been extremely helpful. And then they just love to give. So, you know, one of the things that we do almost on a weekly basis is we go out and provide smoke alarms in some of our more vulnerable communities. And they're free smoke alarms, and we go out and install them. And so the young people come out and help us install these smoke alarms and provide educational service to families on, you know, fire prevention, home fire prevention, or escape plans and things like that. And a lot of that is done by young people that are coming out and just giving up their time.
It's so refreshing to hear you say that, because I feel like our generation gets like a bad rap for being self-centered and constantly on our phone and, like, you know, wanting to take and eating too much avocado toast and not buying houses. So it's nice to hear that, you know, in reality, that's not always the case, because I think it's true. I think
anyone who gives you a hard time on that, you have them call me and I'll set them straight because I'm seeing it much differently.
Awesome. I have a whole list of people. Cool. Well, John, thank you so much for coming on. I mean, I think the Red Cross is one of the first organizations that I learned about ever that did, you know, that was a nonprofit charity and helped our nation, you know, in times of need. And so it's such an honor to talk to someone that's part of such a historical institution. And we, we would love to have you back on at another time, potentially, and talk about specific ways to engage or ways people can prepare.
Sure.
But yeah, I mean,
hopefully not another disaster
hopefully
soon.
Hopefully not another disaster. Yeah.
Better circumstances, yes.
Yeah, we'll just talk. We'll have a good time.
So once again, for anyone wanting to get involved and help with the Red Cross, just visit redcross.org or also call 1-800-RED-CROSS to help volunteer, donate, anything like that.
Yeah, and then again, John Myers, Regional Director of Communications for Red Cross Los Angeles. If you guys want to hear more from us, we're at We Rebel Podcast at Twitter, at We Rebel Podcast on Instagram. Check us out on iTunes, We Rebel, or whatscreative.com. We Rebel. Got it. It never happens that quickly or smoothly. So
thanks, everyone, and we will see you next week.
Thanks, John.
It's a Creative Podcast Network.